Hi, welcome back to another episode of Occupy Interview with the Occupy America Social Network. This is episode 30, and my guests, Mike and his wife, Claire, can you guys introduce yourselves? Say hey, please.
Hey, please. My name is Michael Rivero. I'm the webmaster of whatreallyhappened.com. We've been doing that for about 20 years. I'm also a talk radio host on the Republic Broadcasting Network and a full-time peace activist.
And I'm Claire Rivero, an occasional contributor to the website and also the radio show once in a while.
Sweet. This is episode 30, and this is Occupy What Really Happened. A lot of our listeners may be new to looking for a source of news that they can trust. Where the numbers are showing most people don't trust mainstream media anymore. So the independent journalists like us, according to Ben Swan, we're now the mainstream media.
He's absolutely correct. And pardon me, we don't even call it the mainstream media anymore. We call it the corporate media because it's corporate owned and corporate directed. But the majority of the American people are now coming over to the independent media to find out what's going on, certainly around the world. It's been a major phenomenon. When I started this 20 years ago, there was just a handful of people like myself. And today, you know, it's tens of thousands of independent voices out there guaranteeing the integrity and accuracy of the information being presented.
Keeping them honest. It's the best we can.
Can you give us real quick, and this is my newspaper of choice, and I've got to say I'm also kind of prejudiced on that because I've been a contributor to you guys for a couple of years. But how did What Really Happened get started for the people that are new to us?
It was an accident. I was working. I'm not kidding. I didn't set out to be this peace activist and, you know, a rabble rouser and the rest of it. But a little over 20 years ago, I was living in North Hollywood with my gorgeous brand new wife and working in the film and television industry as a visual effects and computer animation expert. I was working in my home shop, and all of a sudden this photograph came on, leaked by the White House to Reuters, supposedly showing the hand of White House Deputy Counsel Vincent Foster with the gun that he committed suicide with. Now, being in the visual effects business, knowing what makes an image look real to the audience and what doesn't look real is part of the job. And the instant I looked at this photo, I said, this thing's a fake. It's staged. There were so many things wrong with that picture, most especially the fact that there wasn't a drop of blood anywhere on the white shirt sleeve of the hand with which he'd supposedly fired this gun into his mouth, and it should have been absolutely covered. I verified that with photos of genuine suicides by gunfire, and I hard copied the picture out. And at the time, I was working for doing a project for a visual effects company that shared the same building with CNN's Hollywood division. And the next day, I took the picture with me, and at lunchtime, we all shared this outdoor cafe, and I was showing the picture around to my coworkers and saying there are so many problems with this thing. And I remember clearly that there were some people from CNN at the next table listening very closely to what I was saying. That night we started getting threatening phone calls. I was fired from that project that I'd been working on without explanation, and my career in Hollywood just evaporated. And since I suddenly had a lot of free time on my hands, I started digging into the details of the Vince Foster case. And I found the actual FBI documents proving they had engaged in fraud to try and get Vince Foster's widow to identify the dark blued steel gun found with him as the gun owned by her husband, which was actually a nickel-plated revolver he'd inherited from his father. And I went public with that. And originally the website started as a subpage on my animation website, but absent my career, I moved it to its own website. We wound up having to leave Southern California, and we moved up to Washington State, where we felt we'd be a lot safer from all the threats that were happening to us. And I started a new version of the website, which back then was called Rancho Runamucca, because I wasn't taking it all that seriously. And as I did more and more digging, I started finding all this thing about TWA 800, of massive election fraud, and over time the website grew and grew. And when we finally moved out here to Hawaii, I basically gave it its own domain, whatreallyhappened.com, and there's something like 30, 40 gigabytes of raw material inside that website now.
The I spaced out there for a second. I'm going to put a link up. No, I am famous for messing up and getting dead air on the air for an ex-professional. I'm not really very good at this. I still am not very good at this. Anyway, I wanted to, well, that kind of takes us into, there'll be a link up to what you were talking about on the Vince Foster on your What Really Happened page. So our listeners can get a handle on it. Also, it's important to notice here that this, it's a bipartisan thing. A messed up government, criminals in government, it's not a new phenomenon. You're talking about all the way back to the Clinton administration. And we went through several different iterations of problem government since then. And here we are back with the Democrats. The whole Republican, Democrat, left, right thing, our listeners are used to Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, the best anime money can buy. We try to stay away from quote-unquote conspiracy theories, because there's plenty of real history out there that also documents this. You've had Ben Swan on your show.
Yes, I have.
We're going to be with him again here shortly. He's going to be involved with the Open Debates 2016 to try to give us a workaround. If you haven't had a chance to talk to him about that, try and get him back on the show. You're going to find it fascinating. We had a guest that's out of California. They have a working system to get around the Citizens United mess, replacing money with votes. There'll be a link up with that. But anyway, what was you're watching the news every day. Where do you see the left-right? You don't buy into the one party's right, one party's wrong thing either. Can you guys?
No, I really don't. I mean, by heredity, I'm a Republican. I was raised in New Hampshire. My grandfather was drinking buddies with Richard Nixon. But I'm looking at all of these stories on a case-by-case basis and evaluating them on their particular merits. We are nonpartisan. We go after liars and crooks of all parties equally. And what we've discovered over the last 20 years is this kind of stuff's been going on all along. It's just that only with the advent of the independent media has it become widely known to the general population.
There seems to be an attack on independent journalism. You just ran an article today. Just one of the latest examples of that was an independent journalist who was arrested over the weekend for filming the police busting a drum circle, which makes them, of course, really dangerous criminals. He's facing
dangerous drummers.
Oh, it's the
dangerous
musicians.
Drummers.
Only if they were.
Got to watch those musicians. $10,000 bail, according. Oh. I haven't got it confirmed yet, but we're still chasing that story down.
Well, he's going to have a heck of a lawsuit because the courts have ruled repeatedly that police doing their duties in public on the public tax dollar do not have an expectation of privacy, and merely taking pictures or video of them is not interfering with the performance of their duty. Now, the police, of course, are taking an opposite position. They understand a lot of what they're doing out in public is not going to meet with the public approval, and they do arrest people, confiscate their camera gear. There have been cases of cameras just being smashed outright. When it goes to court, inevitably the courts will rule against the police force, and restitution will have to be made, but the police are continuing that policy.
You just ran a story on Scott Olson.
Yes.
That he just took a $4.5 million settlement, but the problem is it comes out of the taxpayers' money. And I think you also ran a story that was showing everybody that was involved with it got a promotion.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing in the government is the people who go out and do these bad things on behalf of the government, they're promoted because the government is wanting this stuff to happen. I mean, and again, nothing new there. Go back and look at the John F. Kennedy assassination. The police officer, the police official who was in charge of Kennedy's security, And the officer, Ray Vaughn, who let Jack Ruby into the basement to shoot Lee Oswald, they were both given promotions afterwards. Ray Vaughn became the chief of police of Midlothian, Texas.
Okay. That one had slipped past me. I'll try and put that link up, too. Another link in the chain here. Go ahead.
Oh, one of the other aspects of policing that is getting so terrifying is the militarization of police. And you wonder, why do these guys need tanks? Why do these people need the very aggressive advanced weaponry that they're getting many times from the U.S. military? It doesn't make sense unless it is to put down some sort of insurrection very brutally and in a very bloody fashion.
Well, I think if we look at like these live fire drills in the elementary schools and the general police brutality, I think the real goal here is to sort of get everybody conditioned to react in fear and horror to a uniform and a badge, especially if there's a lot of Kevlar involved, as a means of quelling dissent and protest. And it's the same kind of things that we saw in East Germany and in the former Soviet Union. And it's all part of a plan to just scare the general population into, if not complicity, at least silence.
Sort of conditioning the response.
Go ahead, Claire.
Sort of conditioning the response, if you will, to one of abject fear.
It's pretty darned effective. I'm scared to death. One of the biggest things we're fighting in the Occupy movement is they tried to it's. Programmed into you is that you're going to fail, so don't even think about it. Don't even think about trying to resist. Resistance is futile. we've talked about that a million times. You can even Google the psychological reports on it. They are aware of it. It's one of their best tools. So we're trying to punch up, hey, they're not going to win. I mean, for every uniform, there's 3,000 of us that aren't in uniform.
Right.
For their one tank in Andy of Mayberry's county, there's thousands of people. Those tanks just lost in Iraq. Those tanks just lost in Afghanistan. Afghanistan. That's what they're doing back here. So they're not going to win this one. They're running a bluff, and we've just got to try to peacefully work our way through this. I think that seems to, do you get the impression part of the problem is they know they're not going to win?
I think they're concerned that if there were a mass uprising of the entire American population, they would probably lose because at some point the degree of military force they would have to bring to bear against the American population would cost them politically in the eyes of the rest of the world and would accelerate the push to dropping the U.S. dollar. Right now, you need to understand that in addition to the almost $200 trillion U.S. government debt, the United States is home to trillions in foreign investment that is kept here with the promise that if those investors make money, they get to keep it. If they lose money, the taxpayers will be made to cover the losses. That's what happened back in the 1980s with the SNL bailout. That's what's been happening since 2008 with TARP and all these other bailouts. But on the day when it is obvious the American people are not going to go along with the wishes of the federal government, those investors are going to start pulling their money out of the United States and crash the entire financial system. And that's why the U.S. government is terrified of this coming to widespread violence. Now, that isn't going to stop them from trying to stage some kind of a very small, controllable, contained revolt that they can put down brutally as an object lesson. And I think they tried to do that twice last year. First, on July 4th, with Adam Kokesh's aborted armed march into Washington, D.C., and then later on when the George Zimmerman verdict was read, the whole week before that came out, the corporate media was out there saying, there'll be race riots, there'll be race riots, or there'll be race riots. They were selling the idea that the blacks should riot if Zimmerman was acquitted. And Zimmerman was acquitted. The blacks did not riot because they realized this was exactly what the U.S. government wanted, and they weren't going to play that game. Only a fool fights the battle the way the opposition wants it to be fought.
Do you guys try to, I know we've run into a problem with just trying to find guests that still have that optimism. It's almost like part of part of the media, part of the turned media or the agent provocateurs or whatever the term of the day is, seems like they're trying to punch that you haven't got a chance. Gloom pornography is one way I've heard it put.
Well, one way to control a population is to take away from them the hope and faith that things can be changed. And you know, so that people just sort of mentally give up and say, oh, well, this is the way my life is going to be for the rest of my life. These days, I don't see people buying into that. And I think one of the advantages we have right now is that the planners inside Washington, D.C., are still thinking in terms of how life was like back at the height of the Cold War in the 1950s and 1960s, where they could concoct any fiction, count on the corporate media to proclaim it the truth across the land, and a very naive and trusting American people would believe that. But those days really are pretty much gone. And although government is still coming up with all kinds of ridiculous stories, like Assad gassing his own people in front of the UN chemical weapons inspectors.
Or the Russians massing on the border.
Or Saddam's nuclear weapons. The corporate media will echo it, but the people aren't buying it any longer. Trust in the government is in the single digits. Trust in the corporate media is almost there. The audience numbers of the corporate media reflect the flight of people from the traditional newspapers and TV media to the independent media.
You're an ex-space guy, too. I was part of Deke Slayton's first private enterprise and space group back in...
Really?
Okay. 1983.
Now I'm impressed.
Billion. Well, it cost me.
Oh.
We got a nice rubber chicken breakfast out of the deal, but basically my job was to explain the econometrics of how you transfer over from a all government-run program to a private enterprise system. And the good news from me as a bright new kid was, well, it's right around the corner. That was in 1983. It's been a big corner. back to hope here. One of the shows we just ran, we had an economist named Dr. Walter Block. He's a libertarian. He was doing a show on the Malthus mistake, and basically the entire economics is based on, there's always going to be more people, doubling rate. There's only one world, so constantly doom and gloom. You're always going to have a constantly less and less per capita share of world. Well, that's been wrong since 1969. All of us spacers have known. That was our first second world. In fact, the European Space Union calls us a binary planet system. I'm sure you've already run into that.
Yeah, there is merit to that idea, given the ratio of the sizes between the Earth and the Moon. But, you know, you need to understand that modern politics really is all about finding a scary hobgoblin, usually mythical, to wave at the people in order to acquire their money and obedience, whether it's Al-Qaeda, killer bees, Y2K, human-caused global warming, Russia. It's always, without something to wave at us to make us afraid, this government really is unable to function, especially at a time when it's destroyed its own credibility. There was even an article that came out about a week ago saying that Israel is at the point where they have to be at war with somebody or the Israeli people are ready to kick their government out. And we're seeing the same situation here where the United States is desperate to escalate our current world war into outright war with Russia and China because they understand the American people are sick and tired of all these little skirmishes. We all understand it's driven by economics. All of these wars, 17 countries so far the U.S. has bombed or invaded, and countless more they're trying to do regime change, and it's all over just whose particular piece of ink and paper they're going to be using for banking for the next 100 years. And that's all that it's about. For all the bloodshed and the gore and everything else going on, it's this clash of civilizations is a war between banking systems.
That's one of the things I really enjoy about the what really happened side. You're running stories talking about we just discovered another moon of Saturn this time. I think that was this week. Did you guys run that one?
Yeah, we ran that one. You need to understand, before I was in the film and TV industry, I was with NASA myself, and so I always have a soft spot in my heart for science and technology stories. based on the real science, I avoid things about, you know, flying saucers and, you know, the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot's love child. I used to work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I have a great deal of empathy with those kids and what they're accomplishing on their extraordinarily limited budget. So, yeah, I do like to post these science technology stories.
It's imperative. The kids really don't even have a comprehension of the half of the population, as far as demographics, isn't old enough to have ever seen men walk on the moon. That's a strange concept, but that's really where we're at now. Somehow,
I'm always teasing kids when we're out there, because we have star parties. We have telescopes, and the neighborhood kids will come over. And, you know, one of my running jokes is, there's the moon. You should have seen it before they walked all over it. And the kids look at me with a strange look in there. What the heck are you talking about?
I try to take the kids out and point up to Tycho and tell them that's where I'm going to build Tycho Bell.
Okay, you trumped me.
But
I'll concede defeat on that one.
Well, the point here is we're not limited to the resources of just this planet. We don't have to be fighting in everybody else's backyard.
No, we don't. It's all about empire. And you need to understand that just as it was with killer bees and global warming, you know, these dire prognostications, and especially, yeah, human-caused global warming, these dire prognostications are based on very limited mathematical models that don't take other factors into consideration. And the reality is that when the human population gets to a point where it's too crowded, there are automatic natural mechanisms that kick in to slow the birth rate. And I know I'm probably going to anger a lot of people who are out there, especially down at the Westboro Baptist Church here.
Oh, yeah.
But I really do think that homosexuality is the built-in overpopulation safety mechanism in the human race, because if you look at the per capita incidence of homosexuality and correlate it to the stress on that society, you see there is a strong correlation. As the pressure builds on the humans, they tend to produce more gay children who thereby start limiting the population growth. And so my view about homosexuals is they have every right to be here and have a life of happiness, and more than that, I think they are an essential key to the long-term survivability of the human race.
We've got a whole solar system to play in. Personally, I'd kind of like to see be fruitful and multiply kick back in here. The most important thing we can produce is new individuals. For every individual out there that doesn't make it, when did we kill off another Einstein? When did we kill off another Mozart?
We're probably doing that right now in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're sending these young kids off to war to be killed. And, you know, only Doctor Who knows what those kids would have, you know, grown up to accomplish had they been allowed to live.
Did you run that picture too?
Yeah, that was mine.
I have trouble remembering where I've read all these different things. And again, that's why I wanted to get across to our viewers. If you really need a source of news, you guys are doing a really good job. So please keep up the good work. We're a little over a third of the way through this show. We've kind of given people a flavor of what really happened. Current events, Fukushima. Are you guys seeing one of the first places I saw the radiation counts, real radiation counts, was on your site? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we're actually very lucky here in Hawaii, because the North Pacific Gyre Current is actually taking the vast majority of the radiation well north of us. They're getting it a lot harder on the west coast of North America than we are here. We do have radiation detection instruments, and shortly after Fukushima exploded, we were detecting increases in airborne radiation. We had a couple of hot days, but right now we're pretty much close to the normal baseline, considering that we're living on an extinct volcano, which is always slightly radioactive to begin with. The real issue, I think, for people to be paying attention to is the extent to which the severity of the disaster was being misrepresented. I mean, now they're acknowledging that when Reactor Unit 3 exploded, the reactor core is what exploded, and it showered portions of the core all over the area. Now, back when it actually happened, of course, the news we were getting is, oh, it's just a hydrogen gas explosion, nothing to worry about. Well, hydrogen, when it combusts, produces water vapor, which is white. And in the photos of that huge cloud over reactor number 3, the cloud was this pale, sickly yellow-green, which happens to be the color of the quadrivalent form of plutonium oxide. So we kind of knew they were lying right from the very start. And the reality is they're trying to act like they're solving the problem, but they can't. The core of reactor 3 is all over the ground there. At least 2 of the other reactors have burned through the floor of the building, and they're down in the ground in the water table. They're leaking radiation into the Pacific. They're not able to clean up all the water they're using for cooling. They're dumping that overflow into the Pacific Ocean. There is a real problem between Fukushima in the Pacific and the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster. There is no longer enough safe, healthy food for the human race to be eating right now. And I'm sure everybody says, oh, it's overpopulation. No, it isn't. It is the technological disasters that have toxified the world. I'm a great believer in technology. If our governments and industries had the will to spend the money to support the whole human population, I'm sure we'd all be living very comfortably. But these politicians, they think like ranchers. We are only going to take care of the humans we actually need, and everybody else, we just need to kill off the useless eaters. We need to cull the herd. And that's where, you know, a lot of wars come in.
And that, again, goes back to Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, that this is not an accident. This is a plan that's been going on for hundreds of years, literally.
Well, we know that throughout history there's always going to be individuals, powerful individuals and groups that think they have some kind of a divine right to run the rest of the world on our behalf. I certainly never signed a contract with them myself. And unfortunately, the kind of people who acquire those positions of power and wealth, they're not really nice people. That's why they get to be there. Somebody once said it's the curse of political power, that it attracts the very sort of people who should never be allowed to have it. And I would extend that to say the same thing is true of financial power. We're in an age right now where we're realizing that virtually the entire global financial system is in the hands of fraudsters and criminals. And while most other countries are starting to deal with that, here in the United States of America, the federal government's attitude is still very much hands off. We're not going to touch the bankers. We're not going to touch Wall Street. In fact, we're going to give them more power to influence the political system in the future.
Dr. Edwin Vieira, I don't know whether you've had a chance to have him on your show yet or not, but he recommended a book to me called Political Partnerology, and hopefully I'm not mispronouncing that.
No, that sounds right.
The science of evil, studied the science of evil. And it talks about psychopaths not as a religious concept, but as a demonstrable, measurable, it's brain damage. They're only 4% of the population. They're causing a huge amount of the damage that's going on. And again, have you had a chance to get anybody on that's talked about that book? The guy that wrote it passed a couple of years ago.
No, I haven't, but I've talked about very much allied subjects. Now, in my opinion, what we're dealing with here is not necessarily the sociopathic evil people themselves, but with
yes.
a system that encourages and rewards sociopathic behavior. We call them the money junkies, the people
yes.
who just have to have more no matter how much they've got. They don't feel rich until they see everybody else around them poor, that kind of pathological behavior. But unfortunately, over the last few hundred years, they've set up a specific style of banking that rewards that kind of behavior, and they have bought control of the government so that there's no negative reinforcement. And for that reason, it is completely out of control right now. And we're down to a situation where if we avoid a violent revolution, which I think is a good idea because the U.S. government's obviously prepared to deal with that,
yep.
We're just going to have to wait. The system is going to collapse because all these private central banks are pyramid schemes. And we're getting to the point where it's going to collapse. And because of globalism, it's all going to come down together. And we need to wake up and realize that, you know, making money by making a good product or offering a service or making a good movie is really cool. But this idea of allowing the money to aggregate at the tops of these financial institutions in the hands of these sociopaths who are going to do nothing more with it than rig the system to bring them even more wealth. That's socially destructive. On my radio show, I commonly say that the common enemy of all mankind are these private central banks issuing the public currencies a loan at interest. And what's really ironic for a lot of people is that the United States originally fought a revolution to be free of exactly this kind of banking, only to be sold back into the slavery of the private central bankers by a corrupt Congress and a corrupt president 100 years ago.
Again, our listeners are familiar with Dr. Beard's work. He did a book back in the before the 1930s, but he documented, and I mean documented, he was a superb historian, Jeffersonian democracy, basically the Jeffersonian movement was to try to counteract the banking power of that time that wrote in the Constitution and left out the Bill of Rights. It took the Jeffersonians creating a two-party system because the money power had their power. As far as they wanted, it was only a one-party system was fine with them. Again, there'll be a link back up at the end of this. But he's documented how the Jeffersonian Party was actually to try to get rid of the National Bank, which was successful, and they finally got it in 1812, just in time for the War of 1812, which put us back in debt.
Those are linked. Those are linked.
Yes.
Because, the United States fought a war to break free of private central banking, and the private central bankers immediately went to work trying to set one up, and it was the first bank of the United States. It was given a 20-year charter. At the end of that 20 years, Congress was looking at what was going on in the economy, and they were seeing these private bankers becoming immensely wealthy on the labor of the American people, and so they refused to renew the charter. This was actually in 1811. And the head of the Rothschild banking family literally threatened the government of the United States of America. If you do not renew our charter, you will find yourself in a disastrous war. Congress stood firm, so the Rothschilds went over to England, and they told the British government, we will finance a reinvasion of North America to bring them back to colonial status and bring them back to the Bank of England at virtually zero interest. And the British government said, yeah, that's a cool deal, and that's what launched the War of 1812. Now, as you point out, the United States won the War of 1812, but it plunged the government into so much debt, they were forced to charter the Second Bank of the United States of America, which also had a 20-year charter. When that charter was up for renewal, Andrew Jackson made it the signature point of his second term in office to shut that bank down. In fact, he campaigned on the slogan, Jackson and No Bank, because the American people knew that the predations of that central bank were what were destroying their standard of living. They were working hard, they were being innovative, they were developing all these new products, and yet somehow the profit from those products was going to the pockets of the bankers. So Jackson succeeded in shutting down the Second Bank of the United States of America. There was an immediate assassination attempt on his life, which failed.
Is that the first assassination attempt in the record, too, just coincidentally?
I think it is, and privately in his letters, Jackson said it was the Rothschilds who were trying to kill him. I have an article at my website, All Wars Are Bankers' Wars, and you don't even need to go to my website if you just Google it. According to Google, there are almost 2 million links to this article all around the world right now. And it tells the history of U.S. wars and assassinations from the point of view of the economic forces behind it. Because anybody who stands up to those bankers, they risk their very life. I'll give you another example. Abraham Lincoln. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln needed funding for the Union Army, and he went to the banks, and the bank said, sure, we'll fund your war for 30% interest. And Lincoln said, I am not going to enslave the white people to the banks just to free the black people. So using his authority as President of the United States of America, he ordered the Treasury to issue his own government-issued currency, the greenback, and that was what he used to fund the Civil War, and it was working so well. I mean, it absolutely terrified the banking families of Europe. There were editorials in the European press calling it a pernicious process and saying, if this is allowed to continue, it will destroy all the monarchies of Europe. All the best minds and brains will go to North America because they will furnish all their money without debt. And, of course, at the end of the Civil War, Lincoln indicated he was going to keep his greenbacks in circulation. He was assassinated, and the greenbacks were immediately ordered out of circulation by the Congress. Then we jump forward to John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy understood that the Federal Reserve was a parasite on the throats of the American worker. And so he signed Executive Order 11110 that issued $4.5 billion in silver-backed United States notes. This is back when a billion was really a lot of money. And that money flowed through commerce, supporting American commercial activity and business without building debt owed to the private central bankers. 5 months after he signed Executive Order 11110, Kennedy was shot dead in Dealey Plaza, Dallas, Texas. And on the Warren Commission sat John J. McCloy, president of the Chase Manhattan Bank, president of the World Bank, and I don't care how good a banker he is, he's not qualified to be investigating a homicide. So the implication is he was there to make sure that the links between the assassination and the Federal Reserve were never uncovered. Oh, it's a crazed lone nut in a bookstore down there in in Dallas, and you know. And of course,
and
the
again,
Federal Reserve, they weren't the only players. I mean, the mafia wanted Kennedy dead because they'd helped him steal the election in the first place, and then he sicked his brother, Robert, on them. Israel wanted Kennedy dead because he was refusing to allow them to acquire nuclear weapons. The CIA hated Kennedy because of the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs debacle. Kennedy was trying to do the job right, and there a lot of people really hated him for it.
All of this is backed up by historians. I mean, real historians. This is not...
Yes.
They try to make it out as a conspiracy theory, and if you can't disprove, you have to discredit.
You know what the biggest government conspiracy of all is?
No.
It's the claim that there are no government conspiracies.
Well, history of conspiracies. That's kind of what we've been trying to take a look at, and we've talked to a lot of really good lawyers. And when lawyers start talking about conspiracies, that would be conspiracy charges, and that's a whole nother critter. We've really got to see more of that. We've only got about 3 more minutes in this second third of the show. Are you seeing anything as far as trying to reestablish law and order? This is a lawless government.
Unfortunately, no.
President Carter.
I think with this massive NSA spying on Americans, that we must presume it also includes spying on our members of Congress, and the Supreme Court judges. I look back at the battle over Obamacare, how Chief Justice Roberts was adamantly opposed to it, opposed, and then all of a sudden at the 11th hour, he does a 180 about face and says, yeah, it's constitutional under the Commerce Clause, you know, votes for Obamacare, and then immediately left the country for a week's vacation in Malta to duck the media firestorm. Certainly this decision that we had just this last week, removing all limits to campaign contributions by the ultra-rich. I mean, it's we've descended into outright fascism, certainly in the economic sense, certainly in the manner the government is treating the American people. We're not a capitalist country anymore. We've definitely gone fascist.
And again, a real historian here backs up exactly what you're saying. He wrote a book called The Best Enemy Money Can Buy. I think you've linked it before. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. If not, it'll be on this page. Our listeners are kind of familiar with it. Basically, the upshot of that was when we were young and sweating, getting drafted to go to Vietnam, according to this historian, and he documents it, and it was never disproven, Wall Street was paying for the weapons that were being used against us in Vietnam. He shows another of his book is Wall Street and the Rise
now,
of FDR.
Now, he's not exactly correct, okay? Wall Street was loaning the money to pay for the weapons used in Vietnam and then expecting the American taxpayer to pay them back plus interest. You need to understand that relationship between wars and banking. Bankers love war. War is the banker's richest harvest. Bankers love to make money off war, and they don't even care which side wins or loses, because both sides are plunged deep into debt to fight the war. Then both sides plunge deeper into debt to rebuild after the war. And when it's all over, ordinary people like you and I, we sort of kind of have what we had before, except the graveyards are a lot bigger, and we're back in debt to the banks for another 100 years. And there's an article I wrote called All Wars Are Bankers' Wars. And, again, you got to look at that to see what this is all about. Do you realize the creation of the Federal Reserve, there was no such thing as a world war, and now we're into number three?
Yes, because I've read your article, and there'll be a link to it. For the people who haven't read your article, I'm hoping they'll kind of get the message and be wanting to read the article. There'll also be links to the historian who does Best Enemy Money Can Buy. He did Wall Street. He documents Wall Street's making loans. You said that better than I did, but mm-hmm. that's not unusual. You have that gift.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but getting back to this idea that the banks loan money to both sides, Brown Brothers yes. Harriman in New York, which is still there. We walked by their offices when Claire and I were in New York for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Brown Brothers Harriman is still there. They were financing Adolf Hitler's rise to power. They just wanted to set up the two sites, get them fighting, plunge them both into debt. Germany only paid off their World War I debt about 6 years ago. So, of course, it's time for a new world war to plunge them all back onto that debt hook.
And again, we will have links to this historian's books. I can't stress enough, these are not conspiracy theories. This is the history of conspiracies. We'll have links to it. Carol Quigley talks about this in Tragedy and Hope. We've got about 19 minutes left in the show. One last piece of current events is we had a 12160 was bumping up that you were going to be on the show, and a question, they were soliciting questions for you. One of the questions that came in was really good. I was hoping maybe you've already touched on this or can put some more light on it. A CIA middle manager, quote unquote, jumped in Fairfax, Virginia. I guess this is last week.
Yes.
I hadn't put the connection together, but that coincidentally was the day before the Senate committee voted to release the torture report. Is that something you've covered yet?
We've covered it only briefly. There is a dearth of factual information about this, but we know that the CIA is never shy about getting rid of a live liability. There are people in possession of information which would, in all probability, prove that the Senate's torture report is not complete, that far worse things were being done than waterboarding to a lot of these people. And anybody in the CIA ranks who's having any kind of moral qualms about what's going on, they're a problem. And that may be what happened here. We're certainly seeing an awful lot of bankers meeting very sticky ends right now. In fact, the CEO of the Liechtenstein Bank got shot in an underground garage. The other former banker, he and his wife and daughter were all killed. They're claiming it was a family tragedy, but there are just far too many of them going on. And we are seeing governments around the world begin to investigate and prosecute for some of these massive frauds like LIBOR rigging, the rigging of gold prices. A lot of people very concerned over the fact that the gold depository at the New York Federal Reserve seems to be running on empty, and they can't return gold to the eight nations that are asking for their gold bullion to be repatriated. And no doubt the people at the very top of these criminal enterprises are trying to get rid of subordinates who've got the incriminating information in order to sort of firewall themselves away from possible investigations.
Okay, so back to the optimism, because we are not part of the doom and gloom pornography.
Mm-hmm.
We touched base on Fukushima, but as an ex-aerospace guy, I keep trying to tell people there's nothing made by man that can't be unmade by man. We've got to actually stop ignoring the radiation that's being released. In Virginia, the head of the EPA, I believe, within a couple of days of the initial explosion at Fukushima, told people in Virginia, of course, people in D.C. tend to be living in Virginia. It ran on NBC4 there in Virginia. Don't go out and play in the rain. This is not just a problem for Japan. This isn't just a problem for Hawaii, which is a little closer than I am back here in southern Indiana. It's a worldwide problem. We can fix this. Back to optimism. If we stop ignoring it, if we were spending the kind of money on fixing this problem that we're blowing literally on the WARs. What are your thoughts? I mean, there are types of mushrooms that this sounds kind of out there, but again, this is science that tend to bioaccumulate this stuff so you can get it concentrated enough to be able to clean things up.
You're very much correct there, and it's not just mushrooms. There are a large number of plants that will bioaccumulate the radiation. Those all work in a limited area. Now, when Chernobyl had their reactor explosion, they were able to cover it over and get away with it because the radiation was contained above by the shield, and they're building a new one because the old one's already decaying. And it went down into the ground, but that's as far as it went. The reason Fukushima is so much more of a problem, and it's not just because we're talking about four reactors rather than one, it's that they built it right by the edge of the ocean. And that means the radiation going down through the bottom of the reactor buildings, it's slowly sintering out through the soil and emerging from the ocean floor. There really is no way to contain that. I know they're talking about this ice wall, but the genie is already out of the bottle. The radiation is out there. It's bioaccumulating in seaweed and in fish. In fact, there was a story just last week about a high school science student in Alberta, Canada, who her father bought her a $600 Geiger counter, and she went down and she was looking at seaweed and fish used in the preparation of sushi because she's a big sushi fan, and she found very, very high levels of radiation. And the problem is, you know, we see all these experts talking about, well, it's Japan, but by the time it gets here, it's diluted, it's watered down. That's not the issue. A fish that is contaminated off the coast of Fukushima is just as contaminated when it's swimming off the coast of San Diego. And exposure to radiation can be over and done with, but if you inhale or ingest a hot particle, that's part of your life from then on. There's no way to get it out. These highly dense materials, they tend to penetrate the tissue walls of the lungs or the gastrointestinal tract until they hit something firm enough to support them, and they just sit there and radiate and radiate and radiate. Contamination is the gift that keeps on giving, and it is a serious problem. And we know this government is not playing straight with us about the severity of the disaster. I have put a lot of thought into the question of what can we do about it. You know, we're at a situation where we need a gigantic 2-mile-wide scoop to literally grab everything around that reactor down a mile into the ground, yank it up, and dump it in one of these extinct volcanoes in the South Pacific Islands for containment. But we don't have that kind of technology. And sadly, whether it's the Gulf oil disaster or Fukushima, man's technology is capable of irrevocable accidents. And I know you like to think that anything made by man can be unmade. Sometimes you can't do that.
I'm just going on the assumption that if we would have been talking in 1957, the concept of going to the moon by 1969 would have been absolutely laughable. So I think if we're trying to take a linear projection of what technology we have right now, and I would agree with you 100%, but technology isn't a linear function. If you turn it loose, if you turn loose the resources of people that have optimism saying, yes, we can, don't you think there is a possibility that just as we change technology between 57 and 69, don't you see any hope for the future here?
With regard to Fukushima, I guess anything is possible, but we're talking about not just cleaning up the Fukushima site, but literally having to clean up the entire planet. And we're talking about a tremendous political commitment. Now, back in 1959, when the space race was just getting underway, it was all about beating the Russians. It was all about justifying the development of new rocket launchers, which were really nuclear weapons delivery vehicles. The first
Correct.
Space
Yes.
launcher that was purpose-built for space exploration and not nuclear war was the Saturn rocket. And so that was driving that. And, of course, as soon as we beat the Russians to the moon, the funding was cut. The problem is our current class of politicians and bankers don't really see any advantage for themselves spending the kind of money it would take to really deal with Fukushima. They're just looking for something that will satisfy the political need of looking like they're doing something. There is certainly more that could be done, but we are already in a situation of having to clean up not just the Fukushima disaster site, but all of the Pacific Ocean, all of the coastal areas along the west coast of North America. They've got a huge radioactive mess in Hanford they don't know what to do about. We have the new leaks from the WIPP facility down in Carlsbad, New Mexico, and they still haven't really cleaned up the Gulf of Mexico. They just sank everything down to the bottom where it can't be seen.
Yes. I guess what I'm trying to take a look at here is I don't really want to get people to the concept of why even bother thinking about this because it's hopeless. Let's just give up. We're all dead.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I'm concerned about a new nihilism now. I mean, if you look at the post-World War I years and the Bohemian movement or post-World War II and the Beatnik, and after Vietnam they called it the Lost Generation. People can become dispirited, and I'm seeing a lot of that already in the U.S. culture. But I think we need to basically decide we're going to fix the problems that we are able to fix right now. There are some problems we don't have the solution for yet, but let's triage, and by fixing the problems that we can fix, we can get to a place where we'll have the political will and the resources to tackle those larger projects.
Are you running the Nuclear Emergency Tracking Center as constant set of show-shifting hotspots so that people can, instead of just ignoring this problem or being afraid of something because they can't see it, they can take precautions the same as when we were kids. We knew there'd be fallout.
We link to that website from time to time when we're talking about Fukushima. We don't have a permanent link here. My issue is I have found a couple of very erroneous readings coming in from some of these volunteer systems, and some of them were quite alarmist. There was even one down here on the Big Island that was reporting insanely hot, and I got in touch with the guy, and he said, that's just the meter's gone bad, and he hadn't bothered to unplug it. A lot of those precautions that we think we know about from the height of the Cold War were as much propaganda as anything else. I'm sure you all remember Duck and Cover, Bert the Turtle. And that film was put out there not to help people survive a nuclear war, but to convince them they could survive a nuclear war in order to silence opposition to a continuing escalation of nuclear arms building. And
I'm choosing to try to keep in mind we've got to stay alive today to even have a chance of being able to take these problems on because it's not going to get solved overnight.
Well, I agree with you on that one. I certainly do. You know, all we can do is what we're doing and keep on working. And like I said, every day, let's find a problem we can solve right then and there. The biggest obstacle to solving problems like the Gulf of Mexico and Fukushima and Hanford and New Mexico is that our current political system is not geared to solving the problems of the American people. It's totally geared to propping up and supporting the money junkies on Wall Street. Once that system comes crashing down and we're forming a new country, we can take a serious look at some of these other issues.
We've got about 7 minutes left. Claire, this is kind of where you come back in.
Okay.
Ron Paul used to talk about to really make a change, we've got to have music. Talk to us. What do you hear in the music now?
Well, I don't know, Scott, if Mike has mentioned, but I am a published composer on the mainland.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
I do use my music to
You're
talk about
around the world,
well,
not just on the mainland.
Okay, but I have addressed this issue with a number of pieces that I've written, and that are out there. One is called Desperation's Army. It's about a very loving couple who, through no fault of their own, found themselves without jobs, and trying desperately to work through a really terrible situation. And that is more folkloric, I believe. And the other is called In Times of War, A Prayer for Peace, which is a very classical piece. But it talks about needing, if you will, some spiritual support, even when things get bad, and to become peacemakers in our own lives.
And both those pieces of music do have videos with them that you can find on YouTube.
And
we'll have links to that.
Okay. And another piece called Lord Help Us Make This World a Better Place. In other words, what can we do today and maybe have a ripple effect in a most positive way? Mike and I are very active in a food distribution set of programs, one for our local food insecure children and the other for food insecure adults, which is co-sponsored by my church and the local Catholic church. And the level of need out there is just, it's incredible. And you listen to these people, you hear them talk story. They didn't want to wind up like this, I can assure you.
They don't deserve to be there. They didn't do anything wrong. It was done to them.
Yeah. And when we found out about it, Mike and I looked at each other and said, okay, this is something we can both feel comfortable about and both get involved in. And we are. And it's nice to see a local program that's really making a difference. And, I mean, when these two church volunteers get together, there's no argument about dogma or discipline or anything like that. The leadership in this church has gotten together and said, okay, gang, we have a problem. What are we going to do to start to fix it? And they're doing it. So I think people coming together in that kind of way is a very good thing. I've heard people use the term spiritual warfare, but the term I like to use is spiritual peace fair. Rather than waging war, what can I do to enhance the peace and security of people around me, of people in the greater community? And I think that if your listeners are asking those questions, they're going to come to some constructive conclusions as well.
Our listeners are in the streets. And to a degree, I wish our listeners weren't in the streets, because to me, I'm not sure that's pretty questionable tactics, just getting out there where you can get beat to death or shot in the head.
It's scary. It's scary out
there.
Yes,
it is.
Yeah.
But the point is, they are doing something.
Yes.
But the wave of action from this weekend, the most encouraging sign that I saw of the wave of action was somebody who was down in New Zealand that basically decentralized Occupy, is their handle as a Twitter.
Okay.
And basically what they did, they weren't real wild about the wave of action because they were a little bit skeptical as to how it was being done, which is kind of what we're touching on. But at the end of it, she did support it in solidarity. And when it was all finished, she went out and did what she could to help homeless people. She gave out part of the Occupy Auckland was they actually have support for their homeless. It is one
That's
of the success
wonderful.
Stories of Occupy. So
well,
she was actually, go ahead.
I was going to say, we're going to have to take care of each other because our government isn't interested in taking care of us.
Nope.
Our government is all about taking care of the war machine, taking care of Israel, taking care of Wall Street. We're going to have to look out for each other, and it's really good practice because when the economy implodes and the federal government comes down, we're going to be depending on our local community just to get by until we can form a new nation, a new republic, and move forward from there.
2 minutes left. Tell me you're optimistic that we're going to make it, please.
I think we're going to make it. I think we're going to make it. There are issues that we're dealing with, but in the end, the people calling the shots, the bankers and the politicians, they're called the 1%, and that means in the greater scheme of things, there just aren't that many of them. And I think people left to themselves without this constant fear-mongering and the desire to teach them to hate the designated target, I think people will tend to pull together. We certainly saw that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, where the Russian people just pulled together, got themselves through for the 3 to 4 months it took for the Russian republics to form, and I think the same thing's going to happen here in the U.S.
How about some music, Claire? Is your music going to try to keep that going?
Well, absolutely. You know, I'm probably going to be writing until I stop breathing, and I'm planning on breathing for quite some time.
Well, that's
about
as optimistic as it gets. They say that music is one of the few activities that causes activity in your whole brain.
Yes.
Maybe it is the most important thing that we can
doing. I think it's one of the most important things. I think being a creative or creatrix in whatever area where you are is good for you and it's good for the people around you. So I love
Unfortunately, the U.S. government just declared too much creativity a mental illness.
That was scary. No, honest, we're not
lost
in that.
I know. I saw it on your site.
Are you kidding me?
No, they're not kidding. They're psychopaths. We're out of time. Guys, thanks. Keep happened going. There'll be links there. You guys have got a lot worse overhead than we do. I know your fundraising activities. There'll be a link there to how to help get you some fundraising.
Well, thank you.
Keep up the good work, guys, please. It's great
to see
that
there's...
As long as it's needed. And we're hoping that it's not going to be needed forever.
When I started this 20 years ago, I figured, 1 or 2 years, the problems will be solved.
Yeah, and private enterprise in space was just around the corner in 1983, but we're getting there, guys. We're getting there.
Yeah, SpaceX is doing some really good stuff. All right, well, thank you very much for having us on the show, and we look forward to doing it again.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for standing.